Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to CAF Chats. I am Major Andrew Britt, and today I am joined by Major Justin Watkins. Welcome.
Andrew, thank you much.
Yeah, absolutely. Justin, can you just tell us a little bit about where you're coming from and where you're going?
Sure. So I just finished here at our JAG schoolhouse, T. Jaglix, in the 73rd graduate degree program. I received my LLM with some wonderful classmates across the services, some civilians, international students as well. I will head to New York. I am going to New York University for a year for an LLM. I will focus in criminal law there. Most of my time in the Army has been in military justice, and so I'm hoping to continue that trend. And so this is going to be a great opportunity to learn in civilian school, to expand my knowledge in the criminal law department, and hopefully take that knowledge to the field once I finish next summer.
Okay, so let's talk about some criminal law topics then.
Let's do this.
And today we have on deck United States versus Johnson. It is a recent decision from CAF, kind of a follow-on case from their last term, which was United States versus Williams. The basic facts of the case are that it was a general court-martial officer panel. Specialist Third Class Devin Johnson of the Air Force was convicted, contrary to his pleas, of one specification of abusive sexual contact in violation of Article 120 UCMJ. Now, the facts are not really the focus of this case so much as what's going on in the post-trial. And Justin, can you talk to us a little bit about what CAF certified as the issue in this case and what it is that they're reviewing?
Sure. So CAF certified three questions. They only answer one. And by answering that one, it kind of moots the other two. So the one that get answered is whether the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces has jurisdiction and authority to direct the modification of the 18 U.S.C. Section 922 prohibition noted on the staff judge advocate's endorsement to the entry of judgment. So that's a lot to take in there for one question. Kind of by way of background, though, what that 18 U.S.C. 922 is, Congress enacted the Gun Control Act of 1968 that prohibits certain folks from receiving or possessing firearms. That act was then amended in 1996 to include a prohibition on people who have been convicted in any court of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence from receiving or possessing firearms. And in the criminal justice world, we call that the Lautenberg Amendment. So the Lautenberg Amendment applies to service members who are convicted at court-martial. It can impact their ability to receive or possess firearms. And so in this case, Specialist Johnson had a box checked on his statement of trial results that said Section 922 was triggered in this case, and ultimately that would get entered into a database that would prohibit him from receiving or possessing firearms. Specialist Johnson appeals his conviction. It goes through the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. They affirm, and then once Specialist Johnson gets to CAF, he challenges Section 922 for the first time on constitutional grounds. Military courts are seeing this a lot in light of a recent Supreme Court case, Bruin. Service members who've been convicted, we're seeing them frequently challenge the constitutionality of restricting firearm possession and ownership. So he says 922, it's unconstitutional, and basically kind of asking, uncheck this box. It was checked improperly. CAF ultimately, though, its big holding says, sorry, we can't uncheck this box, and neither can the service court. So it would be futile to remand it down for them to uncheck the box because they can't do it either.
And so this is kind of a question that the court had already dealt with in United States versus Jahimi Williams from last term. Just some history between that case and this case here. CAF certified a similar question in United States versus Williams first. And then when United States versus Johnson came up, CAF granted it for review, but did not order briefing. That's, I suppose, what we would call a trailer case, because you would expect that the outcome of Williams would then affect whatever the outcome should be in Johnson, because it's essentially the same issue was the initial thought. But after Williams was decided, the court then granted briefing on Johnson. The difference in Johnson was a particular wrinkle that had to do with how the Air Force instruction worked in the post-trial process that differs from the other services.
Right. So the question in Williams, which was an Army case, involved Article 67. And there the court held that this prohibition in 922 from carrying a firearm was not part of the finding or sentence. And so CAF didn't have the authority to act upon that 922 box check in Williams. That left open the sort of separate question that the court answers here in Johnson, which is Article 67, Charlie 1, Bravo, which gives CAF the authority to act upon a decision, judgment, or order by a military judge as affirmed or set aside as incorrect in law by the Court of Criminal Appeals. So Williams answers Alpha, Johnson answers Bravo. CAF here says, a service court may act only with respect to the findings and sentence. And they sort of reiterate, you know, in Williams, this is not part of the finding or the sentence, even if it's part of the judgment. And so here, CAF doesn't have the authority to act upon this 922 indication.
So, Justin, you used the word authority, and I thought this was an interesting point from the case. They discussed what they previously had decided in Williams in this regard, that you're actually looking at questions of both jurisdiction, but then also authority to act.
Judge Hardy, writing from the majority, does a really good job of discussing that distinction. He says, yes, we have jurisdiction here. This case has gone through the Article 66 review. It comes to us through proper 67 channels. And so the case, the entire case, we have jurisdiction to hear this. But what we don't have is the authority to do what you want us to do. I think that's an important takeaway from this, is knowing kind of what your court can and cannot do. And so Judge Hardy says, you know, doesn't say sort of assuming there's an error or not, but simply says this thing that you're asking us to do falls outside the bounds of what our Article 67 grants us, as well as what Article 66 gives to a service court. For that reason, like you talked about in Williams, this idea of collateral consequences, things that are not part and parcel of the findings and the sentence, even if they are attached some way, somehow to those, they are collateral consequences, not a part of the findings and the sentence. And so CAF and the service courts don't have the authority to act on those, even if presumably they are in error.
Now, Justin, I want to talk about some of the post-trial rules that are at play here. So under Article 60, Charlie, the president has rulemaking authority in general or special courts martial regarding how the military judge shall enter judgment into the record. Pursuant to that statutory rulemaking authority, the president has promulgated rule for court-martial 1111 subpart B3 Foxtrot, which then gives to the secretaries of the services the authority to add any additional information to the entry of judgment. And it's my understanding from this case that the services do it differently, or at least the Air Force is doing it differently from the other services. And it's a bit of a timing issue, isn't it?
It is. Judge Johnson addresses that. She concurs in judgment, but disagrees with the majority in terms of when certain things are triggered. This is, as you mentioned, really unique to the Air Force, the Space Force, because of the authority given to the Secretary of the Air Force to promulgate sort of additional rules and regulations. So once a court-martial wraps up, the military judge prepares a statement of trial results, which basically includes all of the information about the trial. The Air Force and Space Force, the SJA, then signs a first endorsement, which includes various bits of information related to that court-martial, to include any processing that might take place under 18 U.S.C. 922. The military judge then signs the entry of judgment, which encapsulates really any changes that have come about since trial wrapped up, and then the SJA prepares, I guess it may be a second endorsement, but it's called also a first endorsement, that again addresses things to include 18 U.S.C. 922.
And in this case, the statement of trial results were prepared. the initial first endorsement was completed, indicating firearms prohibition from the staff judge advocate. There was a reprimand that was adjudged. As part of the entry of judgment, the military judge indicates whatever community authority action was taken. There was no action other than the reprimand language. There was a mistake in regard to the reprimand language. It said sexual assault instead of abusive sexual contact. So the military judge made that correction on the entry of judgment. After making that correction, the military judge signs the entry of judgment. That's at the point that the staff judge advocate attaches an endorsement to the entry of judgment, signing the firearms prohibition in this case.
Right, and that's really the biggest point of contention between the majority and Judge Johnson in her concurrence. The majority seems to include that second first endorsement as when the EOJ takes effect, but Judge Johnson writes that in the rules for court-martial that the military judge's signature is when the EOJ is entered. So there's a slight kind of disagreement with the five judges, but ultimately they all agree that the court lacks authority to alter that 922 indication.
So Justin, if I'm understanding the effect of this ruling, the date certain when an entry of judgment is complete and the trial process has completed and the appellate process has started is not necessarily clear in every case.
Well, I think at a minimum, it's going to depend upon the service regulations. And so here, because you have this sort of unique situation where you have the judge signing the entry of judgment, the EOJ, and then you get the endorsement, it's not clear, presumably, kind of what date triggers this EOJ going into effect. So Johnson, again, would have it be the date the military judge signs the EOJ. The majority doesn't seem to adopt that, so it's not quite sure when that would be, you know, when the EOJ would take effect. You know, here in this case, the majority says that the final completed version of the EOJ was distributed to the parties and that it included the SJA endorsement and the 922 indication. And so it would seem that, at least for the Air Force and Space Force, that the EOJ takes effect at some point after all endorsements are included. It just, at least from reading the case, isn't quite sure what that exact date would be.
So then to figure out what is the triggering act that completes the entry of judgment, in any case, you would have to be looking at a combination of the statute, the rules for courts martial, as well as the service regulations.
Right. All of that authority sort of trickles down to give different authorities the authority to promulgate different rules regarding post-trial processing and to include, as those authorities deem necessary, what documents would go into the post-trial process.
So then maybe if you look at all of these documents, it would be clear in any particular case when the entry of judgment is complete. But I suppose Judge Johnson's point is well received that this creates a bit of lack of uniformity between the different services because the date of the entry of judgment affects other processes that are statutory, such as the timeliness of appeal, as she points out, as well as the timeliness of a new trial petition. And then you could have a different triggering event depending upon which service the accused was in.
Right. And, you know, both those having spent time in the appellate world recognize the importance of dates, what triggers what, timelines, how much time you have. And so knowing, especially, you know, when you're appellate defense counsel, when you're on the clock during the post-trial process is very important.
I do think appellate defense counsel make an interesting argument out of the word error in Article 66, Delta 2. So this provision says that the Court of Criminal Appeals may provide appropriate relief if the accused demonstrates error or excessive delay in the processing of the court-martial after the judgment was entered into the record. So at least the cases I'm familiar with, a lot of the focus here is on excessive delay, but the language is error or excessive delay. So if this case couldn't potentially be an error because it didn't occur after the entry of judgment, what types of errors do you think are contemplated by this statutory language?
That's a good question. I mean, here, it's obviously not the 922 box. And I think that the key language here is after the judgment was entered into the record. And so Judge Hardy cites that in 66, but says that if you go back to Article 60, that the post-trial processing consists of, among other things, any additional information that the secretary concerned may require. And so it goes back to here, the secretary for the Air Force requires that this information be a part of the post-trial process. And so here it's kind of a almost like a cart before the horse kind of issue where because this endorsement has to be a part of the post-trial processing, then this can't be an error in the processing after the judgment was entered because it's part of the judgment. But to get back to your question about error, you'll see this sometimes. I know in ACCA opinions over the past couple of years, you will see ACCA make corrections about maybe base pay if there was a forfeiture or waiver issue that wasn't properly reflected in an EOJ. I think you see it a lot in sort of more housekeeping type, I'll say, errors that the court has the authority to act on, as opposed to something here where it's more of a collateral consequence.
I suppose what I'm struggling with is this idea of what errors could occur after the entry of judgment has happened. So some of those things might have been errors in the entry of judgment, but if we're only focused on errors after the entry of judgment, what really could there be other than excessive delay by the government? And maybe we'll just have to wait and see what case there is, but certainly we can interpret from this language that Congress is providing separate authorities, one for excessive delay and one for some type of other error.
Well, and I think that also raises the question, you know, what do you do with these errors that the court can't fix? And so ultimately here, you know, if CAF were to find 922 unconstitutional, but then they also say, but we also can't fix it, you know, where does that leave an appellant? Where does that leave an accused? Do they have to go to federal district court? Do they have to go to a board for correction of military records? It sounds like those might be the options here for certain errors that are outside, as we talk about jurisdiction authority, certain errors that are outside the authority of a service court or the CAF to resolve.
Certainly. And for the CAF to actually address the constitutionality of 18 U.S.C. 922, it seems that it would have to be in a case where an accused was charged at court-martial with an offense under this section.
Maybe. You know, if the ruling here says once the EOJ goes into effect, whenever that is, that we can't address this, right? The issue is now moot. Right. Then when could an accused raise this issue? I don't know that you raise it during the court-martial. I don't know that you raise it between the announcement of sentence and the entry of judgment taking effect. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But it'll be interesting to see, and CAF has a litany of trailer cases with this issue. It'll be interesting to see if and when they resolve this, how they find jurisdiction to answer that question. And then ultimately, they were to find it unconstitutional, what relief they would say that they are statutorily authorized to provide.
So for takeaways from Johnson, it seems that at least it is a reinforcement that the block checks that are on the STR that get incorporated into the entry of judgment are collateral matters outside of the authority, but not the jurisdiction of the court to review and correct.
Right. I think the court is making it clear, you know, really once again after Williams to say if it's a collateral consequence and there is an error, that is not something that we can provide relief for. That's not the type of error correction authority that we have or that a service court has because it is not part of the findings or sentence.
But then another takeaway from this case, and maybe it's not an expected one, is now we have the analysis for determining when an entry of judgment is entered into the record. And this will be important for many future cases for parties in determining when certain deadlines are due because the entry of judgment starts or triggers certain events and certain rights or obligations.
Right. And as we talked about here, you know, this is very Air Force specific. So you have to know your service regulations. You have to know, you know, what the Army requires, the Air Force, and so forth, because those are different, and those deadlines ultimately matter. Ultimately, they're malleable, right? This authority to promulgate what the Secretary giveth, the Secretary can taketh away. But as we talked about, as Judge Johnson really highlights, these deadlines do matter. These aren't just purely, you know, academic exercises. Appellants and counsel have to know when something goes into effect because of what it triggers.
And it's fair to say that the date that the military judge signed the entry of judgment is not dispositive.
At least here we know that to be true, right? So the second first endorsement, the endorsement after the EOJ, is included in this analysis. And so we know that it's not, at least for the Air Force and Space Force, when that EOJ was signed, it was either on or after the date that this second endorsement was signed.
Well, that's a fairly interesting but also important effect that this case has. So, Justin, do you have any other closing thoughts on this case?
I think this case is a good example of, you know, welcome to life in an Article I court. You know, appellate counsel know this well. If you are at a service court or at the CAF, you have to know what those courts can do. Then you have to be ready for the question of, hey, counsel, I know what you're asking me to do, but do I have the authority to do that, right? Point me to the authority that says that you can get that. And you'll see that at the trial level some as well. You know, you'll have a judge will say, you know, counsel, maybe it's a discovery production issue. You know, what authority do I have to order that? What authority do I have to require that? And so here, I think it's really important to know if you're making an argument at the service court or at CAF, where in 66 and where in 67 can those courts grant you that? And if you can't find an answer to that and you can't point to something, it's probably not going to be a great day for you.
Certainly, and that is an important point to remember. So, Justin, thank you for joining us today at CAF Chat, and we hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been great to be here.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. And the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.